Part 3, Further Considerations. Chapter 12, Good Enough. A good plan violently executed right now is far better than a perfect plan executed next week. George S. Patton. To preface this discussion, understand this is about work, not about relaxing or some combination of the two. If you own a business, your mission is to work hard but not long, to reduce the work week significantly, and to make more money than you require. If you have a job, the goal is to use your 40-hour work week to produce large quantities of superior output in order to quickly ascend the management ranks so you are earning serious money and can call your own shots. This needs to be said, and it's a good time to say it. No matter what your situation, if you are going to work, then work. Turn the radio off. Get your feet off the desk. Stop the pointless babbling with coworkers and put your head down. Get in, do the work, and get out. Smell the flowers later when it's time to give those flowers all your attention. Combining working and relaxing will result in frustration in both areas. In your work, long hours spent in a mishmash of unsatisfying mediocrity. And in your leisure, an unsettled persona. Less than perfect performance is an okay thing. For the work the system method, here is a qualifier. Getting things too perfect is counterproductive and short-sighted. The following story from my background illustrates the good enough concept and the reality that better than good enough is usually a waste of time and money. When I was 24 years old, studying land surveying in technical school, our instructor told the class a story at the beginning of the year to prep us for the technical lessons that would follow. The story setting was the early 70s, when the typical survey crew consisted of a party chief, who was responsible for supervising the actual in-the-field survey work, and three additional crew members. The party chief was given a project, and it was up to him, in those days it was almost always a him, to take the crew into the field, do the job, and report back to the owner of the surveying company with accurate and usable notes so a map of the surveyed land could be created. With the notes and the map, the landowner's questions of property size, boundary lines, and future development possibilities could be answered. A survey project is a linear encapsulated process, yes, a system, and a project begins when the survey company owner tells the party chief, in not so many words, "Here's the job. I presume you can handle it. Be quick and accurate according to the specifications I give you, and then come back and give me your field notes so the draftsman can make a map of the property. Then I can get paid by the landowner." Ben and John. This scenario is about a surveying company and two of the half-dozen survey crews it employs. The party chiefs and their respective crews are to survey the boundaries of a landowner's two parcels of land. The owner of the survey firm assigns the first parcel to one crew, with Ben as the party chief, and the second parcel to another crew, with John as the party chief. The owner of the land wants the surveys performed in order to get a general feel for where the property lines and property corners are located. The survey company owner provides Ben and John with brief yet detailed verbal instructions about what is required. As in any survey project, the crews must measure the distances and angles of the property boundaries quickly, efficiently, and accurately. The degree of accuracy depends on the reason for the survey, and of course, higher degrees of accuracy require more crew time and therefore are more expensive. In survey work, it's a balancing act between speed and accuracy as the crew moves along, physically marking property corners and providing distance and angle statistics to the party chief, who takes notes. Time is always of the essence to the survey company owner because he pays his crews by the hour, but receives a flat rate from the client. In this story, time is even more critical because the property owner has a deadline to meet. The crews must get to work immediately and finish the two surveys promptly. The surveying will be challenging. Each parcel is wooded and undulating and has irregular perimeters. Each is similar in size, several miles in circumference. Based on the survey company owner's verbal briefing, each party chief makes a determination of how much accuracy is required to survey his particular parcel. The next day, the two crews separately gather the necessary materials and equipment and head off to their projects. The two crews go to work, each surveying their respective properties. Ben decides his survey requires measurement to the nearest 1/100th of a foot, a high level of accuracy. Using a theodolite, a sophisticated tripod-mounted instrument for measuring precise angles, and a steel chain for measuring near-exact distances, his crew slowly and methodically works through their project, carefully marking the physical property corners, exactly measuring distances and angles, checking and double-checking their work. Ben takes careful notes in his field book. The four are focused and fastidious, their work exact. It takes the crew 4 days to complete the survey at a total cost of $800 to their boss, the owner of the survey company. Their work is perfect. The submitted survey notes are neat and concise, especially because Ben took an additional day to review them. In the meantime, John determined that his crew would survey their parcel with less accuracy, measuring only to the nearest whole foot and allowing his crew to finish the job quickly. Using the same equipment as Ben's crew, but not taking the time to measure distances and angles as precisely, the crew moves at full tilt. They mark approximate property corners while rapidly taking angle and distance measurements, and John takes quick notes, double-checking them as he goes. They complete the survey in just 1 day. John immediately submits his work, telling the survey company owner that the measured distances and angles are not precise. The submitted notes are smudged and wrinkled, evidence of a quick-moving crew that is not overly concerned with appearances. The total cost for John's one-day survey is $200. The owner of the survey company reviews the notes of each party chief and fires Ben. The party chief who took so much care and produced such accurate work is fired? Why? In land surveyor parlance, Ben committed a blunder. The survey didn't require measurements to 1/100th of a foot, so the additional time expended to provide that level of accuracy was an utter waste. In his original briefing to each party chief, the survey company owner had explained the property owner wanted only a general idea of where the property lines and property corners were located. Ben had not listened carefully, self-enamored with his ability to produce tremendous accuracy. In his zeal for precision, he wasted 3 days and $600 by providing a huge amount of useless information. It was a blunder based on arrogance and narrow vision. Precision that is not required is often just that. 98% perfection. Time and money wasted is time and money gone forever. And a waste of time and money means some other positive thing that could have happened didn't. The good enough rule is especially applicable to working procedures. A 100% perfect document that took forever to create carries an unintended imperfection. The extra time spent creating the masterpiece is lost forever. Therefore, the finished product carries an embedded taint and, catch-22, can never be called perfect. So make your procedures detailed, but don't make them too detailed. They should be good enough so the desired results are consistently produced and so someone off the street can execute them, but no more. See it this way. In putting your procedures together quickly, you are reaching a kind of perfection, the perfection of a useful product created without waste. Throughout this book, I have asserted that you must tweak your procedures to perfection. Now you better understand why my definition of perfection is 98%, not 100%. Regarding the work the system process, are there exceptions to the rule? Yes, there are two. Both your strategic objective and general operating principles should be as close to 100% perfect as possible, despite the additional time it takes to get there. These documents are your guiding lights for today and tomorrow. They are short, and you and your people will read them repeatedly. Imperfections will stand out, overshadowing the message. The strategic objective and the operating principles documents are the brief summations of everything you are and how you will proceed. So, yes, spend good time on them. Beware useless information and whining. Guard your consciousness and your focus. Don't waste time on useless information or complain about what you can't influence. With the people and things around you, be militant about relegating unimportant media and advertisement-driven trivia to the trash pile of useless information that resides on the periphery of your consciousness. Don't let zero-value details poison what is important to your life, no matter how dogged the encroachment. Do you get caught up with what is not fair in the world? That's an utter waste of time if you can't accomplish something tangible to fix the unfairness. And whining and complaining don't count as accomplishments. Choose your battles. Illustration. This is not an expletive clock. For a while, I was a construction inspector working with power line crews that built overhead transmission lines. Following written construction designs, the crews used massive crane trucks to insert enormous 70 to 80-foot wood poles in the ground. Then they go back to string heavy-gauge conductor wire between them. The men on these crews are weather-beaten, hard-living, all-American linemen. Good men, straight out of the union hall. They have the surly countenance of loggers and roughnecks, and are not apt to suffer fools gladly. I was working with such a crew in the hot, windswept backcountry of eastern Oregon when I found fault with the work they had just completed. In sighting down a half-mile-long stretch of six poles, one pole was clearly 2 to 3 feet out of alignment with the others. I pointed out the problem to the crusty foreman. To correct the error, he would have to order his men to go back with the heavy equipment, remove the poorly placed pole from the ground, fill in the old hole, re-drill a new hole, and then reset the pole in the proper alignment. The foreman was not pleased. Nobody likes to do the same job twice, especially when there is a degree of humiliation attached. I will never forget his grizzled scowl and clear disdain for college boy inspectors like me as he growled, "We're building an expletive power line, not an expletive clock." Well, the pole was out of alignment, and his crew did go back to reset it properly. But his power line clock metaphor has stuck with me through the years. That cut-to-the-bone comment, however off-target in that particular circumstance, is an enduring reminder that the quality of work must not exceed the required result. Here's a real-world question for you. When you reconcile your personal checkbook, do you reconcile to the nearest cent? Why? Why not reconcile to the nearest dollar? Wouldn't eliminating a lot of minor detail make for a lot less work? Think about other areas in your life where you are manipulating too much information. Are you seeking useless detail?